Accession number 27244, Mr. John Lincoln, Reel 3. Now, we were talking about your time training with the Royal Army Dental Corps Depot at Connaught Barracks, Aldershot. I'm just going through sort of a typical day's training, picking up the sort of sessions you did. Mm-hmm. You mentioned weapons training, or the rifle anyway. Could you take me through how they taught you the various weapons they introduced you to?
Yes. The basic weapon which was taught, as you know, the medical service is technically a non-combatant, which, of course, is a bit of a laugh, because that's not true at all. But everyone has to do weapons training, and the go through part of the weapons training, of course, is use of the anti-gas, nuclear biological warfare. It's all part of the weapons training system. Now, we were taught in those days on the Lee Enfield Class 3 bolt action rifle. This was the standard weapon of the infantry soldier, yeah, any soldier. You did also have in the military in those days the Sterling machine gun, the Sten gun, and the light machine gun.
Let's take them one by one. So how did they do the rifle? How did they train you in the rifle?
Well, you've got what they call...
Right.
What you actually got first to start with is you've got what they call static training. They had what they called a rifle rest, which was like a triangular metal thing, and the rifle was put into this and clamped. They then taught you how to align the sights and how to get a sight picture on the target, right? You learned the technique of doing this, following the back sight, front sight, so on. You learned how to strip it down and clean it and put it back together again. Okay? All basic weapon training. You then learned how to load it. The dry load it with blanks to start with dummy ammunition. And once you'd mastered all this, the sight picture, the stripping and cleaning and so forth, how to load it, how to hold it, how to take position for firing, you then were marched with your chosen pet rifle down to the range, where it happened on the day I went, it was pouring with rain. You put down your cape. You had a rubberized cape, which was your raincoat. You put this down on the ground in the mud, got down in the prone position, and had to do a grouping of five rounds, right, at 200 yards in a 4-foot square target. Well, unless you've ever fired a Lee Enfield, you don't know what the recoil is like, but it's like the kick of a mule. It really is it really kicks back at you. And to get five in a 4-inch group, 200 yards, for the average guy is almost impossible. You've got the bright shining stars, the odd one, who took to it straight away. But for most of us, we had about four different sessions at this, lying in the water on the range with it pouring with rain, and you fired rifle until you could more or less group five shots in a 4-inch group at 200 yards. Now, that was your introduction to the use of the Lee Enfield rifle. You were then marched back to the barracks, and you had to clean all this stuff till it was absolutely pristine and put it back in the armory, and then that was it until the next session. You progressed from there to where you went down and did what they call a shoot, which is a series of exercises with live ammunition. And at the end of all this, you could get a grading.
Now, what sort of exercises was on the shoot?
Right, there would be single shot to start with, zoning in the sights on the rifle. So the rifle then was measured to you.
And then you'd always have that rifle, would you?
You drew that rifle, it had a butt number, and every time you went to the ranges, you drew that rifle. And you had to take care of that rifle, so that at the end of your 6 weeks when you handed back, technically, I mean, you never took it out of the armoury. I mean, you didn't live with anything like that. It was always in the armoury. And you went down, drew it out, used it, cleaned it, and put it back in the armoury when the session was finished. And, but by the end of that time, you could go to the ranges and you could do a session of a shoot of 20 rounds. You'd have five shots application, that's this thing, single shot, to make sure the sights were in. Then you'd do five shots, and then 10 shots on a different target, to call me a different
range.
Any rapid
fire element?
Yes, the last one usually was rapid fire.
So were they still loading, double loading the clips?
They were loaded in clips.
Two clips,
you got 10 rounds, 10 round magazine, and you load with five, load with a second five, and then you would get 10 rounds rapid. And you had to place the shots in as short a time as you possibly could. I mean, the times used to vary for people who were a bit all thumbs, you know. But you got pretty an average time of dispatching 10 rounds into the target. And mostly pretty accurate. It's a very accurate rifle, the Lee Enfield.
And you liked it?
Oh, enjoyed it, yeah.
And what sort of a shot were you at the end of that process?
Moderate to good. I've always, all of my rest of my army life, I enjoyed doing the rifle, and, you know, every time you see a fair, you're on the rifle straight away, and so on and so forth, you know. It's a good sport, rifle shooting.
Now, the second thing was, you mentioned the Sten. Now, that's a submachine gun.
Yeah. Submachine gun.
Was it the Sten or the Sterling? Sorry.
It was the Sterling. Originally, the original one was called the Sten gun. It was mass-produced and not very accurate and so on. And the Army evolved this one called the Sterling submachine gun. It's a 32-round magazine. You've got a clip of 32 rounds, you put it in, and you can discharge them either in single shots or in rapid fire. Usually you do it in bursts of two or three, because otherwise the recoil takes you off the target.
Now, the Sterling's reputation is mixed. I mean, it's quite. What did you think of it?
It's not a bad gun. You, as long as you hold it firmly, and you use the time-honored method of short bursts, it's reasonably accurate.
To what range?
To a range of 50 yards, maximum for accurate shooting. But you can't use it over a greater distance than that. But we usually do 50 or 25 yards.
Would you shoot from the hip, as in the films, or would you, in reality,
no,
you shoot from...
No, you came up to what they call a presentation with it to the shoulder, right? And you used it like a rifle, mostly. Although you can discharge it from the hip, and then you must hold it in a different fashion. You must get hold of it by the clip housing and use it there. Because if you don't, if you get round and your fingers slip, you'll blow the end of your fingers off from the discharge.
Had they solved the problem with the Sten of unexpected and unwanted discharges if you banged it?
Yes, more or less. There was the occasional discharge, but usually no, it didn't.
So that was that. Now the light machine gun. Was the Bren?
It was the Bren gun, the 3.303 Bren gun.
What did you think?
You were shown it. I mean, we weren't combat troops as such, being medical service. So you were shown it, and you got a chance to fire it if you were lucky, if you were the right number in the on the butt the day that the instructor brought the Bren in to demonstrate it to you. Because the Bren, of course, is a fancy Lee Enfield, in actual fact. It's the 303, but in a light machine gun form. And they are very, very accurate over a good distance, 600-700 yards. And you got a good Bren gunner, and he's good.
Did you get a chance to fire it?
Had a couple of goes at it, yeah.
Were they still doing the old stripping? I mean, one of the things about the Bren gun was
you
strip
it down, yeah. With a blindfold on. All the instructors, they usually, you know. All the instructors, of course, for the medical service were infanteers. They weren't medical staff. They were guys posted in from all sorts of different regiments, usually for medical reasons or whatever, and they came out and they trained the corpsmen in the basic the basic principles of musketry. I mean, so we had.
So they'd more show you blindfold stripping than make you blindfold.
That's
strip.
Right. Yeah.
What about? I should have mentioned with the rifle, the bayonet. Do you do any bayonet training?
Again, you would demonstrate it. It was demonstrated what you had to do with it and how you had to do it with the dummies, you know. It's purely so that you are familiar with it.
You'd actually have a go on the dummies, would you?
Oh, yes, you had a go on the dummies, yeah. I mean, I taught you how to put that on. I mean, you did elements of rifle drill with the rifle as well, up to a point.
What about hand grenades?
No, I never had any experience of those.
And none of the real infantry weapons like the mortar or heavy machine?
No, none of that. You were taught just basically self-defence and defence of the patient.
What other aspect? Now, so that's two aspects. We've looked at training. You've got drill, you've got PT, and you've got weapons training. Any other things in this 6 weeks of basic infantry, if you like, training
yes.
that you recall?
Well, you did the nuclear and biological warfare training.
Not chemical then as well? Just.
Well, it's all the same. It's basically all the same. I mean, in those days, I'm trying to think what the full title was, but it was nuclear and biological warfare, which, of course, biological is chemicals. It's another expression for chemicals. You know, where they stick bugs in a bomb and throw them at you.
What stage do they reach with NBC, they call it now, don't they?
NBC.
What stage do they reach with that training? How did they
train you in that? Very extensive. I mean, they taught you all the background and all the history of the nuclear bombs and so forth, and how you would protect yourself and protect your patients and your environment. And they also taught you personal protection against chemical warfare, i.e. the use of the respirator and all the associated bits and pieces, you know, the powder you have to dab on and all the rest of it. And use of the NBC kit. The noddy suit, as we affectionately call
they
it.
They had the suit then, did they?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Can you describe it? Because I'm just seeing whether it's different. Has it changed much?
Not really. It's a bit more marked now than what it was. Everyone had a respirator. I mean, that was a standard issue. And everyone had the antibacterial type equipment. You didn't have injections, but you had powder you could sprinkle on against burns.
What was the powder?
It was a form of chalk that in a wee packet, and you dab this on to stop if you've been splashed with any chemical or whatever. You dab this on and stop burning and so on and so forth. And of course, you went through the gas chamber. You physically
what
went
was that
in.
Like?
That was awful, because they put tear gas, CSE gas. They explode a shell inside an enclosed space in a room, and you'd be in there wearing your respirator.
Were you wearing it, or did they make you put it on after you'd got in there?
No. You put it on, then you take it off when you're in there. You'd have to take it off so you experience what it was like, so you would know. You would know when you were coming under a gas attack. You recognise the symptoms, and of course you immediately put it on.
The nuclear side of training, how realistic was it? I mean, was this just basically countering radiation?
It was counter radiation. We took part in nuclear exercises. Pardon me. Where we went to different places, and it was mocked up. What a town would look like if it had been blown away, and so on. There was a place in Salisbury Plain where you went to and you had demonstrated what the damage that was done and so forth. And of course you had all the films, long film sessions. And you had to answer questions on it in your examinations.
Any other training? That's the same, you know, any other big sections of training in that 6 weeks? No tactical training.
Up to a point, you did map reading and field craft, camouflage, that sort of thing. You were taught all those elements because you have to do it in a field medical unit, where you've got to camouflage huge ambulance cars and so forth.
So how were they training you in that?
Well, you had static training aids. You had a vehicle which had seen better days, and you were issued with all the different thing called an F assembly. which was a tent of sorts you could erect on a vehicle, and then how to use camouflage nets to camouflage it all. And of course you were taught your personal camouflage, how to camouflage your helmet, you the person, brick up your silhouette, and all the usual standard training for camouflage.
Anything else you might be doing? Basic training, I mean.
Basic training.
Lectures?
Plenty of lectures on all sorts of subjects. First aid.
They'd start the first aid lectures even in the basic training.
Oh, yeah. Basic first aid you were taught before you did any nursing training. Nursing training was where you went on to, if you like. But you were taught elements of first aid and so forth in within the subjects all the way through. But every soldier was taught first aid at a point in APCHO, in basic training. Not as a specific subject, but it was pressed upon you, do this, do that, do the other, you know. It was only like the likes of us that actually specialised in it later on in your training.
And what else would the lectures be on?
Well, that was about it, really. There was interest lectures you had. I mean, you got the dreaded lecture on the pox doctors. Clark came and lectured to you on your personal health and where not to put your weapon, you know, and be afraid of all strange girls that blow your kisses, etc., etc., etc. You know, that was another aspect of the things you had to do. And then, of course, you'd get lectures on how to fill in your basic form requirements, like a leave pass and how to get a railway warrant, all these sort of things, which are general interest, general training for the soldier, so that he can move himself from place A to place B.
Anything on the history of the RAMC or the dental?
Oh, yeah, you got that sort of thing. You had your history lessons, and someone would come and take you to the regimental museum, and you got a tour of that, and so on and so forth. That was all part of it. And you got field hygiene, which was how to dig lavatories and how to purify your water and all that sort of thing. It was all part of the generalised training for your basic training.
So that's what you'd be doing during the day. Now, how long would your day's training sessions be going?
Your day's training finished usually with the evening meal at 5 o'clock. And then you would go into the bull sessions, because you had eternal bull sessions.
Tell us about that. I mean, this is the preparing your kit for kit inspection.
Yeah.
We've done the sort of show thing, but what about, say, how would you prepare for a normal kit inspection? Tell us about the bull, polishing your boots, the rest of it.
Right. For a normal kit inspections, you had a standard for every item of your clothing. All of your shirts, underwear, uniform, jackets and so on, had to be folded in a certain way and pressed in a certain way, and presented for kit inspection so that everything was 9 inches square and laid out on the bed in a prescribed layout. Your socks had to be rolled up, your spare boot laces rolled in circles and bulled with black boot polish till they sparkled and put down beside the spare pair of boots. Your boots had to be bulled, i.e. the toe caps and heel caps had to be bulled up to a high state of polish, which you did, but with things, with candles and ends of spoons, and you melted the black polish onto the leather, and then you bulled it up with spit and small circles until you got a high, shining, hard surface on the toe caps and heel caps of your boots. Underneath the boots, the studs had to be polished, the polished parts of the leather had to be polished and clean, and the instep done with black boot polish so it was black, and the heel plates polished up with brass ore so that your heel plates and each stud sparkled with brass ore, metal polish in other words. The all brass parts of the accoutrements had to be polished. Your tin hat was scrubbed until it was uniform clean and had to be kept clean at all times. And again, any brass fittings to it had to be polished and made clean. And the leather insert, you know, you have a leather insert, You used to have to put mansion polish on that so that it was clean and sweet and didn't stink of sweat or anything like that. And that was all part of the overall thing. And at the end of the day, you'd have a layout where you laid out, starting from the pillow end of the bed, and it was all laid out in sequence down the bed, so you had the full item kit inspection. Again, this would be inspected usually once a week.
What about the room?
The room had to be bulled to a point, as I've mentioned before, the highly polished canvas. If you didn't have a linoleum floor, if you had a wood floor, it had to be mansion polished, and the mansion polish polished up. So the boards of the floor were all scraped, usually scraped with a razor blade, all the dust swept away, and then fresh mansion polish put down, and the whole thing bulled up so it had an overall shine. The beds, you had to wash the legs of the beds, again, polish them with a bit of metal polish so that they all were all nice and neat. The lockers had to be polished with a bit of mansion polish and kept spotlessly clean. And of course, the whole bed area, you were allowed no fluff, no dust, nothing at all. It had to be completely clean throughout. The whole of your bed area had to be free from dust, any debris, any fluff, anything, with the floor polished to a shine. And your bed, again, boxed, the top sheet dollied, so it was taut. The hospital corners, this was a method that you use, where you took the overall cover in, so that you've got a square corner in each corner of the mattress. And then your equipment would be laid out in sequence according to this pattern, which was a picture given to each barrack room, and you had to lay it all out. The NCO would then come round. Usually on the full kit inspection, you'd see the sergeant. This ethereal beast would arrive, and the corporal would spring to attention and grovel manfully all the way through, not to incur the displeasure of the sergeant. He would use the same system. He would open one window of the barrack room, and anything that displeased him would be picked up on the end of a pay stick and chucked out of the window, which you would recover later, and you'd have to go through the whole procedure all over again until they were satisfied the weekly kit inspection was complete.
So you spent a lot of time bullying and doing your kit?
Many hours a day. Yes, many hours in the day.
Would you get any time for recreation in the evening at all?
You got an hour off to go to the naffy. You go to the naffy and you were marched to the naffy, had your hour's recreation, then you came back to the barracks and got on with your bullying. These tables I mentioned were the recreational spot of the barrack room. You sat round these tables with your brasso and your bulb and your boot and so on, and told stories, and you sat there and bulled from 6 o'clock to 10 o'clock and every night.
Was that lights out?
Lights out. And you had to, I mean, some poor guys who couldn't keep up the standard, they used to take a candle and go into the loos and sit and bull their boots in the loo, because they couldn't keep up with everybody else.
Now, what about, how did you get on with the other recruits?
Usually pretty well. You found that we're all in the same boat. You all had the same enemy, i.e. the NCO, whether it was the block NCO, you know, your squad NCO, or it was the sergeant in charge of your section. They were your enemies, and you all banded together against them. And it was a game.
Was there any bullying within the squad, not by the NCO?
Not really. Of course, you see, the modern equivalent of bullying didn't exist in those days. In those days, you did as you were told, you got your backside kicked. And I mean, whether it was mentally, verbally, or physically, it they didn't deliberately come and hit you or anything like that. But, there's always an element of people falling out with each other. There's always the strong and the weak. The strong will take advantage of the weak. This is the law of the jungle. You're all young fellas. Of course, you're all from different backgrounds. The some who were of a violent nature, well, you usually found the other guys ganged up on them and put them in their place. Because you were punished en masse in those days. If one guy did something wrong that the NCOs didn't like, all of you were punished. And I mean severely punished. So he who would not toe the line, he who wanted to be king of the heap, usually got pushed away from that very quickly, because everyone suffered if he upset anybody outside of your little enclave, the hut. But from the point of view of personal bullying, I don't think there were. I mean, you had to stand up for yourself. The army's a brutal place. It's no playground. And you were being taught brutal things, if you like. How to kill people. And okay, we were medics. We were supposed to be the guy that shouted, he shouts medic, and you rush across and stick a sticking plaster on him. But the basic function of the soldier is to kill people. And of course, this happens inside the barracks, the same as anywhere else. But usually, you were buddies. It was your squad against all the other squads.
Now, how did you get on with the instructors? What did you think of the instructors? Yeah, the corporal, the lance corporals.
Well, everyone thought the corporal was a bonehead. But he had a job to do as well. And when you eventually yourself became an NCO, and you were taught right from the start, now, this is a game. We are playing a game. You say and they do. Now, we're not too particular or bothered about how you obtain the do. It's your job to make sure that they do, they, the Toms, the soldiers, do as you tell them. So that means you get a vast cross-section of what sort of NCO you would be. The common parlance of the time, I don't suppose it is that now in the modern army, in those days, you learn a completely new language. Everything was four letters of one way or another. And you all eventually started to use that parlance as a norm. So when he would say, for instance, he'd come in his room and he'd point his cane under your bed and say, "There's part of the shit under your bed." He was talking about the fluff. But you see, it wasn't referred to as fluff. Or you were a grotty, bloody individual, which meant you were dirty, you were scruffy. So it's a completely new language form you learned. And a lot of it was quite brutal. And it was usually yelled at the top of his lungs.
Any problem with your accent? I mean, you've not got much of an accent now, but you did have then, I presume.
Well, I've got an army accent now. I taught us, Linda and I often, the wife and I often laugh, we have army accents because you have to moderate your language so the people who you're dealing with can understand what you say. In those days, I came from Sunderland area, Durham. I spoke quite a colloquial language because that's the way you spoke. I'd never been any further, I said before, I'd never been any further away than Blackpool on my holidays. So I went all the way to southern England and I might as well have been speaking Cantonese. They just didn't understand half the time what I was saying to them. And funnily enough, I didn't understand half the time what the Londoners were saying to me either. The home counties people, as we call them now. Because all the home counties don't talk like this, you know. They talk like this, mate. You do it now at the sign, yeah. And of course, he'd speak to me and I'd just look at him blank, which got me in the hot water again because I didn't know what the NCO said. Because he, would you believe, that particular NCO, he came from Camberley in Surrey. So he was a local guy. So he spoke the Hampshire Patois. So there you are.